We are joined here live in the studios by Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, local writers and activists here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. So before we begin, we should probably say something about the that studio and the transmitter.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah.
So we are going to need to move the station in the next year or so because the building that we're in is being torn down and redeveloped.
Mm-hmm.
It's the Seattle story.
It is a typical
gentrification.
We're going to need a lot of money for that. Moving the antenna is a big deal. It requires engineering studies, consultants, city permits, and so on and so forth. So now would be a great time to get some funding from our listeners. We are an all-volunteer station, and we are supported by our listeners, which we thank very much for doing that. But we're going to need more because it's a special year for us. We need to build up cash so we can actually move.
Yes. Also, if anyone knows of a space that would serve as a studio space and has any great ideas of where we can put the antenna.
Yes, and the antenna does need to be in or near the U District.
Yeah. So let us know. You can contact us through our website. We also have a Facebook page.
A very active Facebook page.
Yes, and if you would like to contribute to our fundraising goal to build up some funds in order to make the move, you can visit our website at kodxseattle.org. We have a Patreon button at the top of the page for regular donations if you want to become a sustaining supporter of the station.
Which helps you hugely.
We also have a PayPal button at the bottom of the website for one-time donations, or you can send us a check and you would make that check out to Earth on the Air Independent Media and mail it to
P.O. Box 45883, Seattle, Washington, 98145. But I want to stress here that this is a project that's going to be, we're starting, the wheels are churning on it now, but it's not like we're looking in the short term for funding. This is like it's a big project, so we're just kind of seeding the idea in your head. Because
yes,
I think we all know
we're starting
some folks who probably have more money than all three of us
put together.
Yeah. So just trying to put that out there. And again, the real thing for the short haul would be if you know of space that would be very inexpensive.
Low rent
for us. We don't need a lot of space, but we're hoping in the U District or nearby.
Yes, think of walk-in closets.
Yes.
Yes.
So anyway, we wanted to put that out there just to get the wheel spinning on your end. So
yep. And thank you very much for your support.
Yes.
It means a lot to us.
And it's the only reason we're broadcasting is because of your support.
Yes. Pretty much.
So, diving into this week, I wanted to start out with the passing this week of someone that I know impacted everyone here at the table. And although isn't necessarily a tradition, we often talk about local activists, and this is more of a...
Yes.
This is more of an inspiration.
Yes.
Yeah, this is international. Terry Jones of Monty Python passed away. Of spam fame, among many other things,
mm-hmm.
And he was very much of an activist after Python stopped putting out material, for social justice causes. And he will be very much missed. He was a main creative force behind Monty Python, which is saying a lot.
Something that I grew up on.
Oh, me too.
All right, so. Diving into local, there was a significant shooting that happened downtown.
I want to put the shooting downtown, I believe it was Wednesday night, mm-hmm. in context. One person died and seven people were injured when a couple people with a beef in front of the McDonald's at 3rd and Pine pulled guns and started shooting each other, apparently. Both those individuals have been identified, but they're still at large. And this is being used very predictably by the Downtown Seattle Association and tough on crime neighborhood groups, it said in the Seattle Times, to paint an alarmist picture of what goes on downtown. I lived about three blocks from there for several years until last year, and it's always been gnarly. There's a history of that stretch of Third Avenue between Pike and Pine that goes back literally to the 50s. Of it being a congregating place for people who are doing black market stuff. And usually it's okay, but that particular night it was not. And it reminds me very much of the jungle shooting a few years ago, where a couple people died in the shooting in the jungle, and the city used it as an excuse to move hundreds and hundreds of people out of their encampments in the jungle and basically just spread them all over the city. It was a total overreaction to a one-time incident, and my concern is that that's the kind of thing is going to happen this time. And certain forces like the Seattle Times and the media are not helping that prospect.
I think what really alarmed people was that it didn't happen in the middle of the night, you know, as many shootings do around Seattle. It happened during right up around 5 p.m. during rush hour on a weekday.
And that's always a busy corner all day long, but particularly on rush hour.
It's a major bus stop right there for the rapid ride lines C, E, and D. So, you know, you'd expect a lot of people getting off work to go there in order to get on the bus.
And there's a light rail entrance around the corner.
Yeah, there's two light rail entrances nearby. So, yeah, I think that was one of the big issues. But again, as Jav said, it's being used as an excuse to talk about how the city's getting out of control with its crime, when in fact we know the opposite is true. I want to talk a little bit about a Seattle Times editorial on the shooting. Of course, it was an editorial, but I think it once again showed that the Seattle Times editorial board has trouble seeing the very obvious disconnect between their own arguments and reality. The editorial was titled "Mass Shooting: A Costly Wake-Up Call for Seattle Leaders." The Seattle Times editorial board not only acts like a provincial newspaper when they run editorials like this, but they appear shocked that Seattle now has big city problems, like, for example, drug gangs in the downtown core.
And this is the same editorial board that for years has cheered Seattle becoming a big city.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Now, I do want to point out, as I just said, that the crime rate in Seattle is at a record low, at least over the last couple of generations. Seattle Times editorial board is freaked out over one shooting, and is using it as an excuse to blame diversion programs. If you read the editorial, diversion programs like the LEAD program, which has been instrumental in driving down the crime rate in the city of Seattle.
People who go through those programs are generally not hanging out on the blade.
Yeah.
They're clean and sober, at least for a while.
No. And they go on to blame City Attorney Pete Holmes and the progressive and therefore, in their eyes, wimpy Seattle City Council and local politicians like Pramila Jayapal, who was calling for gun control legislation. Now, even Mayor Durkan came in for castigation in what I thought was a very funny line, and I'm going to read this as a direct quote from the editorial. Mayor Jenny Durkan said gangs are involved, but gangs are primary traffickers of illegal drugs, end quote. That's the line. And I read that, and I'm like, yes, they are that.
You know, the city's policy, until about maybe 8 years ago, they tried to push people around from whatever corner they regularly congregated on. I remember when Pine between 2nd and 3rd was the big open-air drug market. Now it's 3rd on the east side, on the McDonald's side, between Pike and Pine. Mm-hmm. And it's true, if you're looking to buy, you can probably score there pretty easily. That's not meant to be a tip to our listeners, it's just reality. But that has been the Seattle policy for a few years now, of not bothering to push them around because they just recongregate around the corner. Mm-hmm.
Pointing out that, yes, gangs are primarily traffickers of illegal drugs ignores the fact that gang members carry guns. They're responsible for a lot of gun violence. And it makes this article read like it was left to be written by a very young intern without any supervision from anyone who has experience living in Seattle prior to 2010. Now, if you remember living in Seattle in the 80s and the 90s, drug gangs were responsible for most of the gun violence. There were drive-by shootings, primarily in the Central District. You could imagine.
Well,
maybe
we've solved that.
You can imagine maybe some older folks at the Seattle Times going, "Oh my God, it's not in the CD anymore. The CD is gentrifying. Now it's in downtown. Horrors, horrors."
No, now it's in Rainier Valley, and they ignore it.
Yeah,
But the city's policy for several years has been to either to just ignore it and let people do their business, or they periodically send through bike cops who don't interact with the pedestrians at all. It's the exact opposite of community policing, which is supposed to be the point of emphasis.
Yeah, see, the thing about the emphasis patrols is that these guys are mobile. They're not staying on any one corner where crime tends to be a problem. They're mobile throughout a neighborhood. What I found kind of interesting about the article is that they had this other line where they were talking about how terrible it was that progressive local politicians are calling for stricter gun control laws, but they point out too that it took 15 seconds. Police responded within 15 seconds to the crime scene. Now that's pretty good. That's pretty good response time.
Sure,
and it's really fast. But it also points out that anyone with a semi-automatic handgun can get off a lot of rounds in 15 seconds.
Absolutely.
And that's where calling for gun control really makes sense. And you don't want to make fun of that.
No.
Like the article does.
In fairness, both of the suspects had prior convictions and were not legally allowed to carry guns.
Yes, and
but,
so you
but
have
the
to...
But guns are out there to purchase very easily in a number of different ways.
Yeah, so you have to ask. You have to look at Pramila Jayapal's call for a federal background check on gun purchases and say, that's reasonable.
Sure,
you don't
it is.
Make fun of it like this editorial did. So I just have to say, too, that while the Seattle Times has always, as you said, Jav, loved the idea that Seattle is growing and becoming a booming economy, they just can't seem to wrap their heads around the idea that with big city growth comes big city problems like gentrification, homelessness, and more gun violence. Of course, we're not anywhere near being a city like Chicago that has a real gun violence problem, or a city like Washington, D.C. that has a real crime problem, or New York City or Boston, where the crime statistics are much higher than they are in the city of Seattle. So having some perspective is important, but you can't expect that from the Seattle Times editorial board.
No, they are context-free when they want to make an ideological point.
And I haven't seen this editorial, but I would suspect it's one of the many famous Times editorials that doesn't actually list who the specific authors are.
It just lists the whole editorial board. Now, they also ran today, it's at least today on their website, they also ran an article called Enough is Enough. It's supposed to be objective coverage of a rally downtown in response to the shooting. And the photo on their website that they run along with the article is a photo of some students from the Northwest School as if these students are calling for, a tough on crime stance, when in fact those students were at the rally specifically because they were lobbying for gun control legislation, something that the Seattle Times editorial makes fun of.
Right. And opposes.
So it was deeply dishonest of them to run that photo with that article.
Of course it was. This is not the rifle that you use for deer hunting. These are semi-automatic handguns that can, as Maria said, can kill a lot of people in a hurry. And there's no other use for them, really. So addressing that problem, particularly at a federal level, would make a lot more sense than the kind of things they're calling for. But they're going to use the shooting as a weapon to crack down on downtown and probably pressure Durkin and the city council to pass legislation in response. And it's not really necessary. It's a one-off incident that is not typical of Seattle's crime.
No, not at all.
All right. Moving on, city council bills.
Yeah, some city council bills on homelessness encampments and winter evictions. Shama Sawant brought several bills before the council this week, including a couple that she was castigated by Alex Peterson for involving international taking stances on international issues. But I think for local purposes, we're going to look at her two very important bills that were brought up this week. One was a bill to relax limits on permits for sanctioned encampments. This got a hearing in the Select Committee on Homelessness Strategies and Investments, the new name of that committee. That committee is chaired by Andrew Lewis. There are currently 8 permitted encampments in the city of Seattle, and all of them are either tiny house villages or they contain a mix of tiny house villages and tents. The current ordinance that permits homeless encampments expires at the end of March, so it's important for a new bill to be passed soon, either a direct renewal of that bill or, in this case, an improved version. Now, the current bill that Sawant has proposed has three paths for an encampment to gain a city permit or become a sanctioned encampment. First, through a temporary use permit for 6 months, which can be renewed an unlimited number of times, but it can be difficult to get a renewal on that six-month permit. Plus, it's a scramble to have to do it every 6 months. The second path is through a one-year permit that can only be renewed once. And the third path is through an agreement with a religious organization that has a site that can handle an encampment.
Which is the existing model the city's been relying on.
Yeah, and it's not a sustainable model because not that many religious organizations have suitable sites for encampments. Now, the 6 month permit can be difficult to renew as it's meant to be granted only on a case-by-case basis and is only meant for a temporary basis. Now, the one-year permit places all kinds of restrictions on the locations, so only in non-residential zones and 1 mile from, and it has to be at least 1 mile from any other encampment. And it also places restrictions on the size, placement, and structures allowed on the site. And the ordinance, the current ordinance limits the number of one-year encampments to a total of 3 citywide, and that's the most important thing to note. Now, the third option, as I said, an agreement with a religious organization can be difficult to get because not that many religious organizations are willing to have a homeless encampment on one of their sites, and not that many of them have sites that are suitable, that are level and clear and suitable for the restrictions under the ordinance for these sanctioned encampments.
And HSD also has been notorious for not dealing with the religious organizations that offer to help.
They don't necessarily enjoy or want to work with them. Now, Sawant's bill would relax some of the limitations in the current ordinance. For example, some of its provisions would do the following. They would allow encampments in residential zones. There are far more residential zones in the city of Seattle where encampments could go where they currently can't now. It would remove the requirement that camps be at least 1 mile from any other camp. It would allow an unlimited number of renewals of the one-year permit as long as the encampment complies with all other regulations in the city regarding encampments. It would increase the number of permitted encampments citywide from a maximum of 3 to a maximum of 40, among other changes. Now, the city council had identified the need to relax many of these rules during last year's budget negotiations. So this bill is not a surprise and not a radical change, I think, from the priorities that the city council identified when they were doing the budget last October, November. It's really a natural next step. Nevertheless, the conservative council member, Alex Peterson, who represents the 4th District, raised a couple of, I think, knee-jerk objections. First off, he didn't like the idea of 40 new encampments, which I think means he focused on that number of 40 and didn't see the fact that 40 is just a top limit and that it's highly unlikely that the city will see even 20 new encampments in the next year if this bill is passed.
And it ignores the fact that we've now got literally hundreds of unsanctioned encampments.
Unsanctioned ones.
The need is huge.
Yeah. Now, Peterson also didn't like the word encampment. He suggested that the ordinance only allow permitted tiny house villages with case management services. Fortunately, Lisa Herbold gave some perspective on this and some history in response to his comment. She pointed out that all of the city's tiny house villages once started out as tent encampments, some of them long before the original ordinance was passed, and they were not sanctioned encampments when they first started out. They were what the city now calls illegal encampments, and is in the business of sweeping. So allowing some stability for tent encampments allows them time and resources to convert into tiny house villages, which have a much better record than any other form of shelter in the city.
And much less expensive than the case management stuff that he's describing.
At transitioning people into permanent housing.
Because, number one, these are emergency shelters in a lot of ways. They are for people who have literally nowhere else to go. So, requiring case management and all the rest of this, which is much, like, 7 times more expensive for the city than dealing with simple encampments. It cuts down the number of possible encampments because the city can't afford that kind of case management for so many places.
Yeah. So Herbold did mention that if the 1 mile separation requirement is removed from the ordinance, she'd like to add a requirement that encampments be spread equitably throughout the city and not clustered, for example, in lower income neighborhoods. So that's one change that she recommended.
I'm not sure about that, because the reason that they tend to cluster in places like downtown and the U District now is because it's close to services and close to transportation. Those are the two big advantages.
Yeah, I think
those are important for people who are trying to get off the street.
Yeah, I think her issue is not that there are a ton of encampments in downtown. She's looking at lower income neighborhoods that already have encampments now, have been hosting them for a long period of time and haven't been trying to push them out. But there are other areas of the city where there are zero encampments, and there are neighborhood groups that don't even want to see one homeless person sitting in a doorway during the day, much less have an encampment near them. I think that's what she's concerned about. Now, the ordinance will be discussed again in the next committee meeting, which is on Wednesday, February 5th. And I'm sure there will be several amendments proposed at that time. So if people are interested, that's when it will be heard again.
Yeah, that's that would be hugely helpful if it passes and if Durkin signs it and if Durkin then spends the money she's allocated for.
City Council allocated for that
program as opposed to another program she likes better.
Yeah. Now, the second bill that Sawant introduced this week was the ban on winter evictions between November 1st and March 31st. Sawant's bill was voted out of her committee on Thursday evening. That's the Sustainability and Renters' Rights Committee, with a vote of three council members for it, Sawant, Tammy Morales, and Andrew Lewis, and one abstention. That would be Alex Peterson. Peterson proposed an amendment that went nowhere, that he proposed limiting the ban to only rental properties that receive funding from the city of Seattle. That's about 10% of the city's rental housing stock. But none of the other council members went for that.
That would really defeat the purpose of the bill.
Essentially, yeah. Sawant proposed a second amendment to change the ban into a, quote, defense to eviction, end quote, instead of just an outright ban. This means that the city's just cause eviction law would still apply during the winter months. So, for example, a landlord could still evict a tenant if the tenant were engaged in illegal activity. So that, for example, is one of the 18 just causes under the just cause law. So the just cause law would still apply even over the winter time. There is, of course, still the issue of how the bill would impact the cash flow of smaller landlords who can't afford to carry non-paying tenants for 5 months. Although, of course, those tenants would still owe back rent. Collection can be difficult, and it can be time-consuming and sometimes even expensive for small landlords who don't have an attorney on staff, for example. Meanwhile, the landlord himself or herself has bills that they have to pay, including utility bills, sometimes mortgages, etc. Andrew Lewis mentioned setting up a relief fund for smaller landlords who would need help with cash flow or possibly low-interest cash flow loans during the winter months. But it's not clear yet where the seed money for that would come from. City Council would have to allocate funding for it.
Those are very sensible proposals. Mm-hmm. Proposals. I'm looking forward to the outraged Seattle Times editorial.
Yeah. Although the bill passed out of committee, there will probably be more amendments proposed when it comes up before the full council, and that will be a week from this Monday, the next Monday, February 3rd. So expect some proposed amendments to it then.
All right. Well, related to that, there was an update to the famous McKinsey report.
Yeah, people may remember back in 2018, way back in 2018, the Metropolitan Chamber of Commerce commissioned a study by the McKinsey Group, which is very corporate-friendly, dictator-friendly international consulting firm that is now gotten more attention because it's on Pete Buttigieg's resume. But they looked at the affordable housing crisis in King County in 2018 and concluded that it would take some $450 million over the next decade to fix. Well, they came up with an update to that report, and not surprisingly, since the city hasn't really done much of anything to fix that crisis, it's gotten worse and more expensive. They're now estimating that it would cost $450 million to $1.1 billion more in annual spending for the next decade to fix it. And here's a key quote from the report. It is clear that business bears some of the responsibility for the homelessness crisis. With continued success comes renewed responsibility to employees and communities. Are you listening, Jeff Bezos? The report was also almost entirely focused on people at or below 30% of annual median income. In other words, very poor people who need housing, which is almost impossible to find in Seattle.
Yeah, and they pointed out that the bulk of people who are homeless make under 30% AMI or made under 30% AMI when they were employed.
Yes, and they may well be still be working when they're homeless. Mm-hmm. But there's also a huge housing crisis in Seattle for higher level income groups, everything up to about 80% below AMI. It's very difficult to find affordable housing in Seattle. So, you know, you can take that $450 million to $1.1 billion and probably multiply it a couple times to address that problem. But given the complete inaction the original McKinsey report received from the city, they punted it until the Regional Homelessness Authority was in business, which it now is. You know, we'll see what that authority does with this information, if anything. But it is a helpful context for the almost unimaginable scale of the affordable housing crisis in Seattle. It's been 20 years in the making, so it's going to take at least that long to fix.
Yeah, one of the things I thought was very interesting about that report was that McKinsey had done that report not because they were commissioned to by anyone. They did it pro bono. They did it on their own, and they did it on behalf, they said, of the Seattle Chamber of Commerce.
Right.
So the Seattle Chamber of Commerce didn't ask them to, didn't commission it, didn't pay them for it, but they did
and
the
report.
And
certainly didn't like the results.
Yeah, they did the report anyway, and they delivered it to them and said, here, business community, you guys are responsible to a certain extent for the housing crisis. Therefore, you do need to do something about it.
Yep. And that's going to be
relevant. I thought that was very interesting.
And that's going to be relevant when we get a, you know, tax big business bill before city council again in another month or two.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Moving on. Our friends at Cook Aquaculture showed up in the news again this week.
Maybe your friends.
I knew Maria would want to talk about this.
Yeah, the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife this week granted a permit to Cook Aquaculture to farm steelhead in Puget Sound. In August of 2017, a net pen failed at the Cook Aquaculture fish farm near Cypress Island, allowing over 260,000 Atlantic salmon to escape into Washington state coastal waters.
Which are non-native to this area.
Yeah. The company eventually agreed to pay a $2.75 million settlement with the state, and the state legislature then passed a law to phase out farming of non-native fish in Washington waters. So Cook Aquaculture wants to now use its net pen for native fish farming, in this case farmed steelhead.
Which are also endangered.
Yeah, but farmed fish are crowded into pens. They're dosed with antibiotics and other chemicals, and they carry viruses, diseases, and parasites that could wipe out a native steelhead run if those farmed fish escape in large numbers.
Which will happen at some point.
Yeah, if we look at Cook Aquaculture's
history.
Yeah,
there's a history.
Yeah, nevertheless, the State Department of Fish and Wildlife issued a five-year permit that will allow Cook to transition to farming steelhead instead of Atlantic salmon. But Cook will still need to get water quality permits from the Department of Ecology because fish farms, as you know, are notorious for releasing pollution. Like I said, they produce a lot of antibiotics pesticides. They also produce a lot of waste because you have all those fish crowded into a small area. Cook Aquaculture will still need to get aquatic lands leases through the Department of Natural Resources for some of their sites. The Department of Natural Resources canceled Cook's lease on its Cypress Island farm after the fish pen collapse, and they had earlier canceled the lease on Cook's Port Angeles farm over safety, environmental, and maintenance violations of the lease. Right now, only 4 of Cook's 9 sites in Washington State are operational. They would like to get those other 5 up and running, I'm sure. Now, environmental activists, Native American tribes, and commercial and recreational fishermen all hate fish farms and have been lobbying heavily for the state legislature to ban them in Washington state waters. And we certainly don't need them here. They're a huge risk to our declining salmon and steelhead runs, and people, consumers, are becoming much more educated about the risks of eating farmed seafood, particularly with all the antibiotics and pesticides that are used to produce farmed fish.
And I thought that the state executive branch in general wanted to crack down on these after the pen collapse in 2017. So is this a case of one hand not knowing what the other is doing, or is it just one of these regulatory boards that's dominated by industry?
I think that's a good question for Jay Inslee as he runs for re-election for governor.
I think so too.
How come you didn't talk to the Department of Ecology about, or to the Department of Fish and Wildlife about that permit for Cook Aquaculture?
It would be good to
ask him if he's willing to talk to the Department of Ecology and the Department of Natural Resources.
Of course, one of the huge issues with climate change, which Jay Inslee wants to wrap everything around in his re-election run, is that the degraded water quality is a feature of climate change as well. So why add to it?
Yeah, why add to that?
Good questions for our environmental governor.
Our climate guy.
Yeah.
Yeah. They can put a pen in Elliott Bay, and then we can walk from downtown to Alki Beach.
No.
All right. Moving on. Moving on to the Washington State Legislature. Developments there.
Yeah, I just want to talk about some of the bills, give folks a little update on some of the more interesting bills of the Washington State Legislature this week. Senate Bill 5323, sponsored by Senator Mona Das of Kent, Democrat of Kent, would ban single-use plastic film bags throughout all of Washington state, similar to the ban here in Seattle. It would impose an 8-cent fee on paper bags, which is higher than our 6-cent fee, and also on not just paper bags, but also on durable or reusable plastic bags. Paper bags would have to be compostable or recyclable. The Senate passed this bill by a vote of 30-19, and it now heads to the House for consideration. So the likelihood that it will pass this year is pretty high.
Yes.
Now, another bill that passed the Senate this week is Senate Bill 5395, which would require all public schools in Washington State to offer sexual health education classes that are scientifically accurate.
And
are inclusive of diverse students.
So we can't bring in our abstinence-only lecturer to give our sexual...
Not abstinence-only, but abstinence is part of what can be taught. Now, the bill mandates the inclusion of certain types of information, like information about contraception. Abstinence is one of the ones that are that's mandated. Healthy relationships, how to deal with sexual violence, and discussions about affirmative consent.
And that stuff really needs to start happening in middle school these days, not high school.
Yeah. Now, if the law passes during this legislative session, classes would have to be offered for grades 6 through 12 in the next school year, starting September 1st, 2020. For the little kids in kindergarten through fifth grade, they're not exempt. Schools will have an additional year to get ready to offer classes to them by September 1st, 2021. Parents can opt their kids out by requesting in writing. They have to request in writing. But really, people, I mean, come on. Your young kids need to know what to do if a creepy adult tries to molest them, okay? And that's what's part of what's taught in sexual health education classes for the youngest kids.
And there's a fair percentage by the time you get to middle school who become sexually active.
Yeah.
And they have to have that information.
Yeah. And at a young age, aggressive kids really need to be taught boundaries and empathy so that when they get to middle school and high school, they're ready and willing to hear about things like affirmative consent and how to negotiate a healthy relationship, when to make the decision about when's the right time to have sex.
Yeah. And not ignoring no.
Yeah, and of course, a little body acceptance for everybody is not a bad idea, starting at a young age.
Yes, particularly for girls, but also guys.
So that's a very important bill, and that passed the Senate and is on its way to the House. And it would be wonderful to see that bill pass the House as well. Also this week in the Senate, Senate Bill 6442 was introduced in the Human Services Committee. It would ban private prisons and detention facilities in Washington State. Currently, the only private detention facility in Washington State is the ICE's Northwest Detention Center in Tacoma. Several immigrant rights groups support this bill, including the Northwest Immigrant Rights Project, La Resistencia, the Latino Civic Alliance, the Immigrant Legal Resources Center, the ACLU of Washington, and the Washington State Labor Council.
Hasn't the legislature had bills like this in the past that didn't get there?
And it didn't get there. So we'll see what happens this time around. This bill has just been introduced into committee in the Senate. So we'll see what happens. Its first public hearing is on Wednesday, this coming Wednesday, January 29th at 8 a.m. So if you want to go to that hearing and
truck on down to Olympia.
Yeah. And testify and or hear what some of the experts say.
That'd
be a good thing to do.
Even if you can't get to Olympia, talking to your legislative representative
is
always
important.
A good idea.
Yeah. You can look up online who sits in on the Human Services Committee in the Senate, and you can send them emails or you can call their offices. Another bill that's in the House that is important for folks who are supporters of recreational marijuana is House Bill 2546. That would ban the sale of high-potency marijuana products, particularly oils and tinctures with greater than 10% THC content, unless a retailer has a medical marijuana endorsement, and then they can only sell those products to qualifying patients and providers. The bipartisan legislators, and there are a lot of them who are supporting this bill, are doing it under the assumption that it will ban vaping cartridges that have been responsible for most of the deaths of folks who have died from illness from vaping. But I have to point out too that there's a scientific issue with banning any marijuana edibles that have more than 10% THC. Because, and I'm going to get into the science a little bit here for folks, because marijuana strains, the flowers and plant parts of marijuana plants these days have between 10 to 30% THC in them. When you make a concentrate from them, it's always going to have more than 10% THC in it. Then you have to introduce, in order to comply with this law, you'd have to introduce another product into the mixture to dilute the solution to get it to 10% or less. That's where you get impurities, and that's where you get problems with people reacting to the safety of your product. That's what happened with the vaping cartridges. People were buying them on the illegal market. They were cut with vitamin E oil, which was supposed to be a quote-unquote natural dilutant or natural preservative, and it was the vitamin E oil that killed them.
Yeah. I have a friend who was in the ER for hours after an incident like that.
Yeah, and now that the legislature is proposing banning these products for people who have become accustomed to buying them on the retail recreational marijuana market, doesn't mean those people are going to stop buying them. They're just going to turn to an illegal market, or they're going to try to make it themselves at home, and that's going to be extremely dangerous. Remember, it's these illegal vaping cartridges that have been killing people. It is not necessarily the legal ones that have.
So this bill doesn't address the very issue they're saying
the
it does.
Issue, yeah, and it does set up folks who have become used to buying these concentrated edibles for potentially buying a legal product that could damage their health. Now, I should also point out, too, that edibles, high concentrate edibles make up about 40% of the recreational marijuana market here in Washington State. So we're potentially talking about a lot of people getting exposed to a more dangerous product if they buy it on the black market.
I have confidence in the people who breed marijuana strains, because it's become a huge science on its own in the last 10, 20 years to be able to find ways to get around the law, whatever they set the limits as.
Yeah, that doesn't really address the issue, but...
No, it doesn't, but it is related.
But, yeah, and I want to point out, too, that a lot of people opt for edibles when they buy recreational marijuana because they don't want to damage their lungs with smoke and pot.
Right.
They can get a higher than 10% hit of THC if you want to smoke it, but not all of us want to expose our lungs to that kind of stuff.
Sure.
Now, you could say, well, people can eat more than one dose of an edible or take more than one dose of an edible. But again, then you're doubling up on the dilutant and you don't know what's in the dilutant. And that's my point. So let's move on to some of the other bills. Mm-hmm. Senate Bill 6272 is the Senate version of House Bill 2311, which would increase the state's commitment to reduce its greenhouse gas emissions. It would set new goals of reducing state emissions to 45% below 1990 levels by the year 2030, 70% below 1990 levels by the year 2040, and 95% below 1990 levels by the year 2050. Now, these two bills are likely to pass, although they are also highly likely to be amended along the way. And they both have been introduced now in their committees. The Senate bill had its hearing this week.
And we're currently about, what, 20% above 1990 emissions?
No, we're about 8% above 1990 emissions.
Okay, so it's even more substantial.
We would be much higher if we hadn't set limits back a while back. So that's why it's important for these bills to pass. Also, several gun control bills were introduced this week. I just want to quickly mention four of them. Senate Bill 6077 would ban high-caliber magazines with more than 10 rounds. Senate Bill 6294 would require handgun owners to complete gun safety training before they can renew a concealed carry permit. Senate Bill 6406 would make a theft of a firearm from a home, store, or business a Class B felony with a maximum 10-year prison sentence and a $20,000 fine. In a similar vein, Senate Bill 6402 would make any crime that involves the use of a stolen firearm a Class A felony, subject to a maximum life sentence in prison without parole if over the age of 18, and a 25-year life sentence for someone under 18. That's probably extreme. But these bills often get amended, and the legislature doesn't have a good record of passing gun control legislation.
No. And that magazine limit bill that you mentioned first, that would probably directly apply to the downtown shooting this week.
Yeah, and that would be a very good bill to pass. Like I said, the Senate has a rocky road with gun control legislation, even though it tends to be very popular at the polls. So we may see none of these bills pass this year in the legislature. We might see only one of them pass. It'll be interesting to see if any of them pop up as initiatives to the voters later this year.
And which rural Democrats oppose it.
Yeah, it will be interesting to see that.
All right. Is that it?
That's it.
All right. It takes us on
for then. This week.
There's more coming.
Oh, yes.
On to national and impeachment news.
Yeah, I'm going to go through this pretty quickly because it's gotten a huge amount of media attention. But we had the impeachment trial and the presentation of the case against Donald Trump by House managers with very restrictive rules that were amended to be a little less restrictive at the very last minute. So they had 24 hours in which to present their case, and they did so Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. And I thought very effectively, at least if you were concerned about facts, which most of the Republicans in the chamber did not seem to be concerned about. They did a very good job. They were very clear. They were very methodical. They introduced a ton of evidence that I'm sure Mitch McConnell would prefer they not have mentioned. But we had this morning the spectacle of Trump's lawyers trying to defend the president, and they used several different lines of attack, attacking Adam Schiff as being dishonest, which is kind of irrelevant because he was, you know, he was presenting factual evidence. saying President Trump did nothing wrong, which nobody believes, and saying that it didn't rise to the level of impeachment, which the House managers had also previously addressed, saying if this level of corruption and willingness to sacrifice national security for personal gain is not corruption, the framers would not have put impeachment as a mechanism in the Constitution, because that's what they were primarily concerned about. After these presentations, the Senate will vote next week on whether to allow hearings and evidence. That requires four Republicans to side with the Democrats in order to allow it. And it's, I would say, fairly likely that none of the Republicans who voice concerns about this will actually vote against the president, lemmings and all that. It's not a real trial without witnesses and evidence. It simply isn't. And anybody who has ever watched Law and Order understands that. Yeah. The major question, and I think one of the reasons the House managers were as much addressing the cameras as they were the Senate chamber, is making this case to the American public so that they do not forget it this fall. Because that's where the real referendum on whether Trump is fit for office is going to come. And we can only hope that he doesn't do too much more damage between now and then. I'm not banking on that, but let's hope.
He's already talking about the damage he will do if he's reelected. I noticed this week he mentioned that because his tax cuts, which were supposed to pay for themselves, haven't, and he's run up a record federal deficit during good economic times, which is pretty much unheard of. He's now proposing that if he's reelected, he'll cut Medicare and Social Security.
Yeah.
Medicare and Social Security.
He has already cut benefits like the SNAP program, which, hungry kids are hungry kids. It's not their fault.
Yeah, and that's something that's being hotly debated in our state legislature right now, is how the federal cuts to the food stamp program is going to affect Washington residents.
Yeah, what Trump tweets gets all the attention, but what his regulatory agencies have been doing for the past 3 years is going to take decades to fix.
Yeah.
He's really taken a thrasher to the social safety net in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, not just the social safety net, but to environmental protections and all kinds of regulations, from food safety and quality regulations to water quality, air quality, you name it.
Yep.
And also this week, Lev Parnas tape surfaced.
Oh, yes. We had a surfacing, last night, of a tape that Lev Parnas had of a conversation from April 2018 in which Trump very aggressively was telling somebody, get rid of her, get rid of her tomorrow. I don't care. Do it, okay? It is a very mob-like tape. And apparently it was in response to goon number two in the TV adaptation of all this, Igor Fruman, who was indicted along with Lev Parnas a couple months ago, telling the president totally unsubstantiated rumors that Yovanovitch had been bad-mouthing him, which would run contrary not only to Foreign Service and Diplomatic Service regulations, but she's been abiding by those regulations for 30 years. So it's a pretty unreliable tip. But he took it at face value and took great umbrage that somebody would ever bad-mouth him. And
gosh,
so we got that response.
Donald Trump believing a man over a woman?
It's hard to believe.
Who would have thought?
Or believing the worst possible of a woman?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. No, it's not at all surprising. Mm-hmm. Yovanovitch pressed his buttons in a number of ways, especially because she's a woman with power.
Mm-hmm. Which the Democrats might consider when you're thinking about who you want to vote for on the Democratic primaries. Might be fun to see Elizabeth Warren take on Donald Trump and see how he reacts.
Yeah, for that I was really looking forward to Kamala Harris if she had gotten the nomination.
Oh, she would,
because
definitely.
She would thrash him, and she's a woman of color, which is even more alarming.
Yeah, unfortunately, I don't think she was really prepared to run for president because she did not seem to have a set platform, and she could not stay committed to particular positions in her platform, which I think really made her hard to support.
It made it harder for her fundraise as well.
Yeah.
But she'll be back.
Yeah. Eventually. I hope she runs again.
Yes.
But with a better, more firm,
better platform. Yeah.
And a better set of donors, particularly small donors, behind her.
Yeah.
All right. Also, last week we didn't have time to mention Virginia becoming the 38th state for the ERA.
Yes.
For the
ERA. About a week and a half ago, Virginia became the 38th state to pass the Equal Rights Amendment, which, of course, dates to 1972. Most other states passed it in the immediate years following that. And there's going to be a court fight now over what exactly is the deadline for state legislatures to pass this. The Department of Justice predictably has said that the time has passed, but they've not articulated what that deadline was, and there's no mention of it in the Constitution.
It's worth mentioning that I don't think that the Constitution doesn't have a set deadline when these things have to be passed.
No, it does not.
That sets up the argument that there is no deadline.
Exactly. So we'll see that resolved in the courts this year, probably. And then Donald Trump has something else to worry about from women. not just the ones who've accused him of sexual assault, which is only a few
Donald
dozen.
Donald Trump.
Yeah, that's true.
All right. Also, I'm not going to pronounce this right.
Glyphosate.
Thank you.
testing. Glyphosate is the active chemical in Roundup, which is the weed killer that has been linked to non-Hodgkin's lymphoma and is considered fairly dangerous at this point. And apparently California wines 100% tested for glyphosate because, of course, it's used in harvesting the grapes. And most domestic beers also, and some hard liquors as well, have it in them. So that needs further testing, which may or may not happen under the Trump administration. But it could be a huge economic blow to grape growers, particularly in the West. But we'll see. And it's an argument for using alternatives to glyphosate, which are safer and just as effective.
Yeah. It's also an argument for drinking organic.
Yes.
Going organic.
Although about 25% of organics tested positive as well.
Even though organics contain pesticides in them too, it's not at the same level as it is in conventionally grown. And when you buy organic, you're creating a market for a product that then puts pressure on the growers to and you're spending more for a product that's more profitable that puts market pressure on the growers to convert from conventional to organic.
Absolutely.
And that's always good.
Yep.
And you're also bringing about where people that work on these farms and these facilities are not being exposed to this toxin.
Yeah, and they're the primary people who have gotten sick with an non-Hodgkin's lymphoma from working with Roundup.
So you're supporting the laborers too when you buy and consume organics.
Because God knows they don't have health care coverage.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And then on international, it appears the coronavirus is spreading.
It's going to be a problem. So far, there have been about 1,400 confirmed cases. 1,370 of those have been in China. It has spread to every Chinese province now. But, of course, it's concentrated in the city of Wuhan, which is a city of 11 million people in the center of China that people pass through for the New Year's celebrations when they go to Hong Kong or wherever their hometown
is. That's the largest mass migration in the world. Is every year around Chinese New Year's,
people
migrate from cities out to the countryside to their families.
And most of them would normally go through Wuhan. That has been shut down by the Chinese government. They have also shut down schools for at least the next couple of weeks. And to their credit, McDonald's and Starbucks have said they're going to close their stores until at least mid-February while this resolves. Meanwhile, it is also spreading through people who travel from China to these countries to a number of other countries. There have been two confirmed cases in the United States, one in Snohomish County, which we heard about, and one more recently in Chicago. And a number of European countries have now had people test positive for this. The death rate is about 3%, it appears, although we don't have a good sample size yet. But it's still a very serious disease and one the World Health Organization is monitoring very closely. Notably, the United States government, aside from possibly doing screening of non-white people coming in on international flights, has not taken any steps in response to this. And we'll see if Donald Trump can tear himself away from his TV and his Twitter page long enough to do something.
It's actually, I think, when a new virus like this arises in the context that the Wuhan virus has, it's a really good argument for strong regulations of food supply and of markets and how food is handled and distributed. Now, we know in China that they may have regulations on these things, but they're not well enforced, and there's quite a bit of corruption involved in their food supply
system. And apparently the market that was the epicenter of this was not particularly regulated at all.
Yeah, no. And so when you have live animals and they come in contact with people and with other types of food, viruses that originate in an animal reservoir or animal population can easily spread to the human population.
That's what happened here.
And that's what happened here. They theorize that that's what happened here. And it seems pretty clear that that's the valid theory at this point. So that's something that health experts have been warning us about for a very long time, that new very deadly viruses can be transmitted from animal populations into human populations in places where the two live or exist close together, and where you have unsafe slaughtering practices of an animal species very close to your other types of food supply.
Yeah, and given the number of people that travel to and from central China, this does have the potential to be a truly global problem.
Yeah.
We'll see how it develops in the next week.
Yeah, the info I was reading about it this morning and yesterday, they currently, I'm not sure if I'm using the right term, but the transmission coefficient is about 2.6. So every person that gets it on average transmits it to 2.6 other people.
Yes, because they can be carrying it without knowing that they're sick, because they don't get any symptoms for a few days.
That makes it very communicable. So.
Yeah. And, we've already seen this in China, but it's very hard to control it once it spreads out globally to a number of countries like this.
Yeah.
All right. So we'll be watching that one. Perhaps closer than other things.
Yes. Yeah. While. We'll be talking through masks next week.
Yeah.
No. Okay. Events.
Yeah. Coming up tomorrow is a event at Town Hall, Ethan Seneca downtown. Jacqueline Ensign is touring in support of her book, Catching Homelessness. She is a nurse from the South who became homeless herself after she was laid off. And she's approaching it both from a public health standpoint and from her personal experience. So it should be very interesting. It's 2:00 Sunday afternoon at Town Hall, Ethan Seneca, $5 entrance.
Yeah. On Wednesday, there are two events that I wanted to mention. There's a march and rally for safe staffing and patient care at Swedish hospitals, hosted by the SEIU Healthcare, 1199 Northwest. That's from 3:30 p.m. That starts at 3:30 p.m. at the Swedish First Hill branch at 747 Broadway, and then everybody will march downtown to Westlake for the rally following. Also, Wednesday, January 29th is a speaking event, Children in Immigration Detention, Health and Human Rights. The UW Center for Human Rights is hosting two speakers, Dr. Scott Allen, who has testified before Congress about the lax medical care and unsafe conditions for children in family detention centers, and Professor Angelina Godoy, who teaches at the UW, will speak about the UW Center for Human Rights research into children jailed by ICE in Cowlitz County.
And the Center for Human Rights has really been a leader in researching this stuff
and getting
that information out.
They've been researching children jailed by the ICE in Cowlitz County here in Washington State. So that event is from 7 to 8:30 p.m. on Wednesday in Thompson Hall, room 101. That's the big lecture hall in Thompson Hall on the University of Washington campus.
They're actually embroiled in a lawsuit from
the UW Center for Human Rights.
Right, from Department of Homeland Security, trying to prevent them from getting the information of the detained children.
Who's detained,
And
some information on them. Not identifying information, but just statistical.
So, mm-hmm. All right.
So that would be a really good event to attend. And as we said at the beginning of the show, we are just starting the ball rolling on looking for a new space for our antenna and our studio. So we are fundraising for that. And if you know of a potential space where we might be able to go, please let us know. You can go to our website at kodxseattle.org and click on the Patreon or the PayPal button to make a donation. Or you can send donations, make checks out to Earth on the Air Independent Media and mail them to
P.O. Box 45883, Seattle, Washington, 98145. And you can also shoot us an email if you have a suggestion on idea on where we might move to, mm-hmm. or hook us up with people that might know that. And do so at contact, the word contact, at kodxseattle.org. All right, so we'll plan on seeing you both here next week.
We'll be back.
Either with a mask or without a mask.
Right.
All right. And you are listening to KODX LP 96.9 Seattle and streaming online at kodxseattle.org. And just wanted to point out that we are also, in addition to doing the over-the-air broadcast and streaming, we're also available via podcasts, via iTunes, and now also via
Spotify
and Google, whatever the Google version is.
Google whatever.
There's certainly a Google version.
Yes. All right. And, of course, the NSA always keeps
I'm sure they take recordings as well.
Yes. All right.